Hi, it's Lucy, and welcome back to a brand new episode of The Real Girls Club, my podcast where I put a spotlight on the talented women working in cinema. Today, I'm joined by the brilliant Regina Graves, a set decorator whose work has brought some truly unforgettable worlds to life. From the quiet elegance of The Irishman to the gritty poetic landscapes of A Complete Unknown, Regina has a real way of turning spaces into stories. We dive into her research and buying process, her love for thrifting and sourcing the perfect pieces, and how she used set decoration to recreate everything from Bob Dylan's New York apartment in A Complete Unknown to the stark, haunting prisons in The Irishman. It's a thoughtful, inspiring chat that'll have you looking at set design in a whole new light. Now let's get into the conversation. So I saw the film, I think it was like a week ago now, 2 weeks ago, and just loved it so much. It was everything kind of I hoped it to be and more. And I want to go and see it again already because it was just such a fun experience. I mean, in a very, almost like in a modern way, it felt like a musical because it was more music than it was dialogue, I think.
Definitely.
So yeah, I loved it. And also just visually as well, it completely transported me to the 60s in New York at that time. And, you know, the streets as well and like his apartment and everything that we'll go into a bit later. But yeah, great. I loved the film and I want to see it again already. Anyway, let's just get into it. So I love to sort of start out by asking, before we talk about A Complete Unknown, about you and about your interests when you were growing up and whether you were always interested in art and decoration and films and storytelling. Did you have an early idea that you would want to work in this kind of role from a young age?
Definitely. I've always been really artistic growing up. I come from a family of artists. My two older sisters were very artistic, much more than me. I always thought, you know, they were always drawing and doing, you know, different things. Both my sisters, well, my older sister went to art school, but I've always just had an eye for it. I think, you know, artists or creative abilities came out through drawings and sculpture and things like that. But mine came out through, I think, more, I've always liked to design and decorate. My mother used to come home and I would actually like rearrange the furniture.
I bet she was happy about that.
You know, I would always just get into that whole thing. Yeah. So I always thought that I'd either be like an art teacher, a furniture designer, or an interior designer. I never thought that I would be a set decorator. That kind of came about, you know, by accident. But I went to school for interior design, like I said, with the intent of becoming an interior designer. And then when I got out of school, I took a job. I was looking for jobs. I couldn't find anything in the interior design industry. So I answered an ad in the Village Voice that said someone with sales experience, someone that likes to draw, someone that loves movies, knows their different styles of period antiques. And that happened to be at a prop house called Eclectic Encore Props in New York City, which I have to be totally honest, never knew, you know, a prop house even existed. I wasn't even into that whole, I didn't even know that there was a thing called
a thing.
Yeah. I mean, I you know, when you watch movies, you always see production designer, art director, never knew what I was doing. Related into that. So I worked at Eclectic Encore for about 5 years and met a lot of production designers, set decorators, print ad stylists, and then just was like this drawn in. I said, this is like what I want to do. I could use my interior design skills and put it towards film, which I love. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know,
worked my way. Perfect crossover.
Yeah, fell into it by accident.
I mean, that's really lucky to come across that job offer. It sounds like it was kind of the perfect timing as well. And I'm surprised you couldn't find anything in interior design, though. I mean, I don't know at what moment that was or where you were at that time exactly. But
well, yeah, I was looking more. Yeah, I was back like in 1988. And at that time, interior designers. So I had like a degree in interior design, but you needed more. I didn't have like the business end of it. And a lot of them needed to be licensed, which I had to go back to a whole new thing of school to be. You become licensed to be an interior designer. And I didn't do all that.
Okay.
So I'm glad I fell where I fell.
Yeah, I mean, worked out well for you in the end. I mean, working on one of the biggest movies of the year, really. Did you have any sort of mentors along the way while you were starting out in those early years, like people that kind of guided you or that you learned a lot from and inspired you?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, you know, at Eclectic, my boss, Suri Beeler, she was just so knowledgeable in film and just like the whole, the historical parts of furniture and all of those type of things. And then when I left there, I was lucky enough to assist a woman named Jessica Lanier. And I started working with her on Woody Allen movies. And then from there, I mean, she was a huge mentor. She taught me so much. Then I worked for George DeTita, who you may have heard of. He's a really big decorator in New York. I've worked for a woman, Susan Boda, Deborah Shoup, Beth Rubino, Carolyn Cartwright. I worked for a lot of great decorators in New York, and I was really lucky to work and learn from them. And my role, I started out usually with them as either like an assistant or a buyer. I mean, it was years before I took my own movie as a set decorator.
Right. Okay. So yeah, you're really sort of assisting these other people on their jobs first.
Yeah. Or just even buying, you know, being a buyer or what have you. And I learned, like I said, I learned so much working for them and seeing how they worked. And because there's just so much that has to be done in the world of set decorating. It's not just, you know, acquiring things for the set. You know, it's also the business end of it and doing your budget and managing people and handling all the stress and the time, you know, constraints that we have. So I find myself really lucky for
it's such a great place to be as well. I can imagine in New York, you know, full of creatives and artists, sort of inspiration all around you as well, all the time with the museums that are there as well. But yeah, it's just sort of like a melting pot of lots of creativity. So let's now sort of go more into a complete unknown. Can you walk me through the sort of creative process when designing this film? Because obviously a lot of the period when you're looking at research, I can imagine a lot of it was in black and white. So how do you go about deciding on color and textures? And from the minute you get the script or you accept to do the job, how does it unfold from there?
So I was lucky enough when I started on the project, our production designer, Francois, had already been working for almost 4 years on it, and it had stopped for different reasons. So he had accumulated with his researcher libraries of different photos of Bob's apartment, of Columbia Studios, of Pete Seeger's, of Jones. I mean, anything you could think of, New York in the 1950s, New York in the 1960s. But I also did my own research and read as much as I could about Bob, about Joan, about Sylvie, about Pete, and maybe one out of, you know, 100 pictures that we had for each set had some color in it. So we really based it off of like color palettes of like the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and used a lot of the feeling of like a technicolor photograph of the 60s to kind of base the palette on. We wanted it to be really muted and grainy and almost like with browns and greens and subtle colors.
Do you also think about how it will complement with the costume design as well?
Oh, definitely. I mean, there were talks early on and all throughout filming with Ariane and the wardrobe department. We would show them, you know, the different paint colors that we were choosing for the walls, the fabrics that we were using on sofas, on curtains. There was always communication with them so that we didn't, you know, that we were always on the same, you know,
the same page. And it was like almost like a palette page. Almost, you know, like that really.
Yeah. And her compliment, you know, her palette would always complement ours. And we wanted to make sure that ours complemented theirs. And if they didn't, we would change things. But most of the time we were just like right on with them, like all the way through with what we were choosing and the choices that were made.
I mean, for the production designer, Francois Audouy, if I'm pronouncing his name properly, you know, it seems like a long time to start prepping, you know, 4 years in advance. But then again, it's such a big movie. And I think any movie probably requires to start researching that much in advance. You know, you read about a lot of other films as well in general, and you hear the director's been maybe writing it for something like 10 years. But these projects do take a lot of time and preparation and research to really for it to come to life, you know, the finished product at the end. I'm wondering as well, were you involved a lot with the location scouting and how you're going to decorate these different locations and sets?
No. So, well, going back to like the 4 years, I mean, they were supposed to start up. I mean, this has been, you know, a long time coming, this movie. And then COVID happened, and then Timmy had other obligations, and then it got postponed again. And then we did come back to start filming, and then the writer strike, and we were put on hold for like a year. So that's why there was so much time involved, you know, but no, I don't really have any kind of say in the location most of the time. Francois would come back and he would say, oh, we're looking at this. We're looking at this. How do you feel? Do you think there would be much more work in this space to turn it into a bar than this one would be? So he would have insight, or he would find locations and then come back to me in the art department, you know, the art director, to find out how we can do things. But it was ultimately up to he and Jim to pick out where the locations were. And a lot of the times the locations have to be found where, if we're doing, you know, a certain amount of work in a day, that there were two or three locations nearby that they could just, you know, we could jump to. So that's how they're chosen also.
Okay. And when, you know, you were sort of beginning to talk about the project with the director, James Mangold, what was he saying to you as he wanted of the vision? You know, it's obviously, it's not all of Bob Dylan's life. It's this specific part of his life. So how did he approach you and say he wanted it to look? You know, what was he also coming with his own research and his own sort of idea of how it was going to all look visually?
The only thing that Jim really wanted was he wanted it to look real. He wanted it to feel real. He didn't want it to look like a postcard. He wanted the grittiness. He wanted, you know, he wanted people to see like the dirt of New York City, you know, the age, how everything ages over time. He was just more interested in the reality of it all. And that's all we just kept on trying to provide for him is just real life. You know, that was his only concern. He early on, like, looked at all our boards, looked at all our research and was really happy with everything, but just kept on, you know, saying he wanted it real.
Yeah, immersed in reality and everything. Specifically with this film, you know, it's incredibly detailed and immersive. You know, you really feel transported to this time, you know, when Bob Dylan was sort of exploding into fame, really. And how do you sort of go about balancing that historical accuracy of the time period? You know, it's so defined by such like social issues like the Vietnam War and the civil rights movement. So how do you go about, you know, making sure you're accurate to those, that sort of time period, but also adding your own kind of artistic flair? You know, it sort of feels new yet familiar at the same time. Like I can see that grittiness, but it also feels, you know, new in a way, like a film I haven't seen before at the same time. So yeah, how do you balance, you know, the those two sort of things beside each other?
Well, it's kind of hard. I mean, we really have to, as much as, like I said, research that we have to do our own research and make sure what we're doing and what we're putting on screen is from that time period or relates to that time period, because we don't want to be off in any certain way. It's also really hard to find, this takes place over 60 years ago, to find things to put on screen, you know, that existed 60 years ago and to find something that's original and pristine condition. So sometimes you have to make alterations, you know, or substitutions, should I say, but make sure that if they're not from that period, that they have the feeling of, or all I could say is like feeling of or quality of. It's a hard balance because we were just trying to make everything look as old and, like you were saying, new, because it's as old but new at the same time. It's a really delicate balance to try to do.
Yeah, it's definitely a fine line between sort of authentic and new, because, you know, Bob Dylan has been interpreted many times in films, but yeah, you want this to feel new and modern and also appealing, I guess, to a new audience as well in some way. Was there any times as well that you couldn't find a certain prop and do you have to create anything from scratch? Is that something that happens a lot?
It does happen a lot. For this job, there were some certain things we had to take leeway with. Like we couldn't find like the exact, you know, model typewriter that he had. So I think they went like one model up because, you know, we couldn't find one that worked. Or like the phonograph in his bedroom had to be a different style because we're finding something that's pristine and that needs to work. In his, like Bob's apartment itself, there was a lot of furniture that he built. So we wanted to build and recreate that. His desk, we had to recreate. There's probably, you know, in Columbia Studio A, when we did Columbia, there was a lot of things in there that we just couldn't find that we had to build, like rebuild. Mm-hmm. Lighting fixtures we had custom manufactured to look like some in research. So there's quite a lot of building going on when you can't find the actual piece that really means something to that space.
You've got to sort of get as much research as possible and then create it in the best way you can, you know, to make it look like it was from that time. I mean, you talked a little bit about his, you know, his apartment there, his village apartment is such an iconic part of the story. You know, it's very detailed and it's almost like a proper intimate look into his personal private life. You know, I guess somewhere that most people, you know, haven't seen into. I mean, I haven't, you know, I've heard his music and I've seen some films, but, you know, I've never had a sort of proper look into his, you know, private life and where he made his music and he rested and everything. So how did you go about approaching, you know, designing that space, kind of reflect his personality and his own sort of creative energy at that time?
The thing was that when Bob first moved to New York, you know, he was like 19 years old. Here's this kid, he has no money. He meets Susie Rotolo, who's Sylvie in the movie. And he's, I think, like 18. So they're living in the village. We had photos of his apartment. And we know, like I said, that he built, you know, a lot of the furniture. He built the shelves in the kitchen. He built the shelves behind his bed. You know, we had photos of he and Susie in the apartment. You know, there's like this stuffed animal dog behind his bed that's always shown. And so we knew like a couple of things that were in there. But you have to figure, you know, New York in the 60s, these kids have no money. They probably found things in thrift shops. You know, off the street. So we kind of wanted to reflect that. Like they're young. They probably picked up miscellaneous things all over the place. He's obviously musical. He's artistic. There's a lot of books that we had on the bookshelves. We just try to really get into his background to see like what he, Bob, like would like and what he would be surrounding himself in. And that was a really fun part of the job. I mean, just trying to put all of those little pieces together.
Yeah, definitely. You probably have to do your own sort of great amount of thrifting in, as well to get the certain, you know, props for the apartment as well. Are there any other details in the apartment that you think, you know, fans of his early years might recognize? Certain things in the apartment that you put in there is kind of like little Easter eggs or things that maybe I might have noticed on a first watch? Because there's so much to look at. And, you know, I don't think I can get everything in one sitting. I'd have to see it again and pause as well.
Yeah, you have to really pause. You know, it's like I don't even know if you could tell, there's a violin that's up on like one of the shelves that maybe he like, you know, played around with. There's like bongos on the floor. He has a really great record collection, like album collection of the time, and of like all of Bob's favorites were in there. You probably can't see them all, but we put those in there. Books, like I said, there's books on the shelves of, you know, he hung out with like Kerouac and, oh gosh, the Allen Ginsberg. So there are books of on the shelves of them. There's a lot of, you know, there's like Chianti bottles, because I'm sure he drank like Chianti, tons of ashtrays because he smoked like a fiend.
Yeah,
there were just, I'm probably forgetting so much stuff. There was a bowler's cap that we had that we found in one of his research photos. There was a lot of, you know, Susie, his girlfriend, was an artist. There was a lot of her artwork in there. And Bob also doodled a lot. So there's a lot of like little doodles that we had hanging on the wall that were like Bob's doodles that we pinned up or like taped up everywhere. There was just so much stuff in there. In the bathroom, I think I had a pendant from like Minnesota or was it New York? I don't even know. But there was like a whole bunch of different stuff in there.
Must be so fun to decorate, I can imagine. And I mean, how are you going about sourcing these props? Is it a mixture of, you know, from prop houses or thrifting from, or are you traveling as well to go and find them in certain other parts of the world? Or is it, you know, shopping, you know, brand new sometimes? You know, what is it? I mean, I'm sure it's a mixture of all of the above, but.
There's a mixture of all. The only thing that was brand new in his apartment, I think, were the curtains that we had put up and the shades that I had made for in there. But I have to say, everything in his set was vintage. It was thrifted. It was either purchased by myself. Like I love to like hand pick and go shopping for main characters of any movie or film I work on. I just find that so important. I just have to like touch it and see it and feel it and just like, oh, Bob would have that, or this is for so-and-so. So a lot of it was actually shopped in the tri-state area. Some of the pieces, like things that, you know, we really wanted to match and couldn't find, like that yellow chair that he's photographed in and documented in. My assistant found that on like Facebook Marketplace, and I couldn't believe it because it was like the same shape and it was like perfectly worn and had the studs around it. Like the stereo we bought online, like on eBay, because that was the only place we could find something like that. That stuffed dog we found on eBay, a lot of his artwork we had reprinted, our graphic artists reprinted it, but the majority of it was purchased by either myself or my assistant. And
that's so interesting.
Bathtub, the fixtures, the kitchen cabinets, the refrigerator, the stove, the ironing board that comes out of the wall. I mean, the tile, everything is like real and functional and working and
so amazing, so detailed and so interesting, especially if you love shopping and browsing and looking for things. Yes. Then like it's the perfect job for that kind of person. I mean, if it's similar to buying gifts for someone else, would you say, when you're buying for characters, although it's not gifts, because, you know, but is that how it maybe feels in some way?
No, because I feel like I'm the worst gift giver.
I know, I was gonna say, actually, so I feel the same. So yeah, maybe it wouldn't be the same.
I feel like I think too much into it for gift giving, but it's when I'm on a, you know, a TV show or a movie, it's just so relaxing to go out and shop. And a lot of times I don't get to shop as much as, you know, I used to be able to, because there's so much more managing going on. I just love going out and just taking the whole day and thrifting and finding things. And like I said, touching things and feeling things.
And I guess, you know, if you know, you have maybe either a mental list or an actual physical list that you know what you're looking for. So it's different to, you know, maybe not knowing what to buy for someone. It's a bit different to that. I'd love to talk about as well Joan Baez's house and also Pete Seeger's house, which are quite different. I mean, Pete Seeger's is much more of a cabin, and Joan Baez, it's like, feels like this sort of modern mid-century house, a very warm sort of, I mean, both feel very warm actually, kind of in their atmosphere. Can you tell me about the process of designing, you know, her house and how it reflects her character and also Pete Seeger's sort of family home?
So Joan, you know, Joan's house, that was a location that they found. We found in New Jersey, and it was supposed to be, I think Monterey, I think is where she lived, California. So it was supposed to have this kind of California mid-century look to it. And it was the perfect house. It had the kind of the sunken living room and the fireplace. We knew early on that And Joan also was a bit more successful than Bob at that time. She had some money. She had a Jaguar in the driveway, but she was also very young. We found out that a lot of her colors, she loved like burgundy. So we kind of use like jewel tones in there. You don't really see a lot of her house, which I wish you would.
Yeah, it's quite a sort of, you know, brief scene. It's not, we don't see it for that long, but for what we do see, it's lovely. It looks like something straight out of Architectural Digest or something.
Yeah. And I have to give credit to the owner. We did use, you know, we couldn't remove like the light fixtures in his house. There were certain things you couldn't do in there because everything was original. And we used his dining room set that you see in there, but the living room furniture we changed. And like I said, we wanted to make everything was kind of like jewel tones for Joan. And we wanted to make it, you know, that kind of more of a bohemian feel, but and have contrast to like from Joan to Bob. Like they were just two different, you know, from like Bob's apartment to Joan.
Yeah,
there's just going to be such a contrast between them.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah. As you were just saying, you know, she was doing better financially than he was at that point. And it's very visible, definitely, in the two different interiors.
And exactly. And to see where he was at his point when he went there to his house, that, you know, maybe years down the line, this is what he would amount to. Or, you know what I'm saying? So yeah. There was kind of a very big contrast. But Joan's house was such a really pretty, it was a pretty house. And there's so many things you didn't see that we hung, like these beautiful, I found like these vintage beaded curtains and we hung them in the windows. And we had this beautiful canopy bed because James Mangold said to me he would love a canopy bed. So that's why we had a canopy bed in the room and really beautiful cactus in there. But that was a really nice house. So different from the rest of the movie, I felt.
Definitely. And so then about Pete Seeger's house then? So how did you go about designing that?
Oh, Pete Seeger's. I loved Pete Seeger's house. So Pete
Very
Seeger's
cozy.
House. Oh my gosh, it was. And I could have moved into that. So that was another location we found close to like the Pennsylvania borderline, but on the New Jersey side. And it was a log cabin. But the thing about that location was the interior of it was very modern. We actually removed the whole kitchen from the location, all of their furnishings, stripped it down.
Oh, wow. Sounds like a long process. Well,
oh my God, we were in there for like 3 weeks before we started shooting. It was absolutely insane. And again, because Pete Seeger and his wife, they were building this house. He built his house on his own and wanted to show the progression of like he was still working on the house. So you see some like plywood walls. I'm not sure if you noticed that in the film. Mm. You see like exposed electrical switches. And
stuff, I feel like I remember seeing ladders, but maybe I didn't. I don't know.
Yeah, there were ladders. We had like some paint cans. There was like a loft over where the kitchen table was, where there was a storage area and there was like some work equipment up there. And yes, there was a ladder. But we wanted to show like he was like his house was still a work in progress. But again, with Pete and Toshi, like their house, we didn't have any photos that were in color. So everything was in black and white. So we wanted to, again, you can go and try to be as correct as we could to portray their family the way it was. And so we went about and we were, again, trying to find things that related to Pete and Toshi, and they had three kids. So we wanted it very, very lived in. But like 2 days before we were filming, Ed Norton decided to come in, do a walkthrough of his set, and started telling, he came in with Jim, and he was telling Francois and I, oh, I went to the Seeger cabin over the weekend with Pete's daughter. And she was telling me that the appliances were red. They were like communist red. And we were like, oh my gosh, really? And then we're looking at the, you know, Francois and I pulled out the photos. We're looking at the photos of the refrigerator. We're like, oh, you really can't tell. It looked kind of, you can't tell in the black and white photo.
Yeah, it's hard to know. Depending on maybe like the contrast, it might help you see how dark it is. But apart from that.
So he goes on to tell us about the refrigerator and the stove. And then Ed Norton was telling us, you know, and he has a cabin and his cabin has the actual chinking between the logs and it makes it feel so real. And he also pointed out that he had a wood burning stove. So of course, like he was very nice about everything. He leaves and Francois and I look at each other and we're like, well, should we make this right?
Yeah, so no, of course, I think it's something that would otherwise irritate you if you didn't change it.
Yeah, because then we're thinking about oh my God, like we didn't know that these were red and how would we have known? Mm. It wasn't like any of his books or biographies that we read that he had, that we knew that he had the red appliances. So anyway, we decided, we found a red, a beautiful red chamber stove, and then we painted the refrigerator that I had red to match that. But then, of course, you know, we had to get into the scenics came in and did all the chinking between the logs for, you know, for Ed to make it look more realistic. And then I went out and, you know, I had to get a brand new wood burning stove because the one, it was just on my mind. So we kind of fixed everything for Ed to make it more comfortable for him. But we also wanted to be correct about it all.
Yeah.
And I think it was a really great decision, even though we were going crazy for 2 days and trying to get it all in there. But it's one of my favorite sets in the movie. I think it's really warm and
definitely
very, very believable. And it just speaks, you know, Pete and Toshi. And I just love it.
Yeah, it does feel like a family home. And what were you saying about chinking? I'm not familiar with that word.
So, so it's like the material that goes between the logs in a log cabin. So it's almost like you see it's like white, you know, between the logs in a real log home that has been put together, you know, that has been made years and years ago. I don't know exactly what the material is, but our scenics just did everything by hand and, you know, log by log by log to add this white, you know, line of material.
Wow.
I mean, it's like the little details.
Oh, it's the little details, but I feel like in a way it's probably a good thing to be a bit of a perfectionist in your job, or is it a bad thing? I don't know. But like, you know, it helps you see all the details that maybe not everyone will notice, but overall it adds to the complete immersion in the film and the world that you're trying to create. I was going to say,
definitely.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about the exteriors. So from the sort of streets of New York, you know, the signs and the storefronts just all look so authentic. And I loved it. And also, well, I'll talk about that after, but yeah, how did you go about, you know, designing the exteriors of the world that, you know, it was during that time? And is that a lot of sourcing things, or again, creating all these signs and storefronts from scratch?
Well, the graphic designer really designs, well, the production designer with the graphic designer designs all of like the store signage and all the, you know, the graphics and everything that you see on the streets. I mean, they had a huge job in the art and the set decor, scenic department with, they hand painted signs and, you know, the graphic artist design, it's really hard for them. We had like 3 graphic artists on, which were fantastic. And to get like the feeling of that time period with the correct fonts and the whole design of it all, just to make you feel like you're back then. And then it's like a whole process. Then it gets printed, then it goes to the scenic department where they overpaint it and they, you know, age it and everything else. A street scene like that, a lot of people are involved. You know, we to shoot on a contemporary street, a lot of the signage is a big plus for us. We added a lot of awnings to storefronts, and then we just awnings. I don't know what you call them the canvas awnings that come down in front of like the store where you roll them up when it's
I don't know what that's called either, but maybe like
balances, maybe, I don't know, like umbrellas, what do you call
tarpaulin?
Them
tarpaulin? No, it's not tarpaulin. I know, I can see what you're talking about.
Yeah, so we call them like storefront awnings, which
kind of
a lot of canopies.
Yeah.
So we add a lot of those to period films but that's what they had back in like the 50s and 60s in front of most storefronts. So a lot of those were added in. And as far as like this, the Greenwich Village street, I mean, we dressed like two whole, you know, sides and 1, 2, 3, 4 whole blocks.
Wow. It's a lot. You know,
storefronts while like these stores were still operating, you know, some of them
even do that.
Like a juice bar, one was a restaurant, and, you know, a couple were like bars or what have you, doctor's offices. So there was like a gang of people, and my assistant Chuck Potter really like took control of doing the whole Greenwich Village street scene. Mm-hmm. And, you know, finding a lot of like the period products for the different stores and the signage and the record stores. It was a huge like build is what we call it, and undertake. I mean, we had a crew out there, like Chuck and his crew, they were out there with the scenics and the construction department and the set dressers working for like, I think that was almost like a 3 or 4 week build also.
Wow. Although once you know, you see it all complete, you must really feel like, wow, I am literally back in the 60s right now. It feels so amazing to see it that way. I want to talk about as well the sort of Newport Folk Festival, because it's such an important part in Dylan's career and a real turning point as well, you know, when he sort of goes from acoustic to electric and everything. And I'm wondering, were there any specific props or set pieces used in these scenes that helped bring these moments to life? And I'm assuming, you know, it must have been from, again, you know, maybe news cutouts or photos, videos that you had of this specific moment in his career that helped you sort of bring it to life?
So luckily we had all of those things. We actually had like video footage of it. We had photographs, and these photographs we did have in color. But I think what sold the Newport Festival for us was a lot of like the blue and white striped tents that you saw. And then there was some fencing with the blue and white canvas, which it was so hard to find canvas tents. My assistant found a tent maker in England, but then had them made in India.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know how they made all of these tents and all of these fence coverings for us in like 3 weeks, but they did. And it was amazing. I think that was really a big selling point for us. Other than, you know, like all the period musical equipment that the props department brought in.
Yeah, so much to do in such little time. But I can imagine once you've been asked to do something, it's like you've got to make it happen if you can. Lots of wooden chairs. Yeah,
there were like we needed like 1,000, you know, period wooden chairs. We were like, how are we going to find them? And we just like piecemeal them from so many different places.
Yeah, I guess you have to have good contacts and have your eyes and ears everywhere and think outside the box as well to try and find these things. And how much are you actually on set during shooting? Or are you more there for pre-production? Yeah, how much are you actually pre, post, or during? Which is your most part of being in the film set? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm usually there pre. Obviously, it's like dress the sets and get things ready and stuff. And then what we call is the day the set opens, or it's like the first day on set, I'm always there to open the set. So I'm always there with the production designer, with the art director, with the set dressers, with the on-set dresser. It's for when Jim, you know, or the director first comes on to see if there are any changes, or if he's moving the camera somewhere, or we need additions. And I just want to, we always are there to make sure that everything is good and we don't have to run out and scramble for something else that the director might want. So I'm usually there for like to open set, make sure it's all going well. It's like the first shot is up and then I'll leave and I'll go on to the next, you know, whatever shooting the next day. With this movie, we were back and forth in so many of the sets so many times, like for redresses for the passage of time, that I felt like I was on set more than usual.
And that must be nice as well to see it sort of like come to life with acting happening, you know, in the moment. I'd love to actually now talk about The Irishman, which was a film you were nominated for an Oscar, a BAFTA and a Critics' Choice Award in Best Production Design back in around about 2019. So what's it like to have your work honoured like that? Is it something that you even maybe think about or hope for it to happen? Or is it just you kind of do your job and then it's like a bonus, I guess?
No, I mean, I'm not going to lie. That's, you know, when you do your job, you know, a goal, like, oh, I would love to be nominated for an Oscar or a BAFTA. Like, wow, that's a great honor, especially to be nominated amongst your peers. So being nominated for The Irishman, I mean, that was just incredible. And to be nominated with Bob, who I've worked with before, and, you know, and on a film like that, it was just, and Martin Scorsese, I mean, that was like a dream of a life, you know, a movie, a dream of a lifetime. And it was a great project to work on. And yeah, I can't even put into words of how it all felt. It felt amazing.
Yeah.
And to see like, the movie doing so well. And that was hard. That movie also like took you across so many different time periods.
Yeah, of course. I was going to say, it spans, you know, multiple decades. And it's a very long film as well. I think it was about 3.5 hours. Although like now The Brutalist has come out and that's about 3.5 hours as well. So I guess it's, you know,
Now it's the norm.
It's the norm now. Although I guess The Brutalist wasn't on Netflix. Whereas with Netflix, you know, you could pause it and be like, okay, I'll come back and watch the last half. Whereas there was like an interval for The Brutalist. But yeah, how did you go about using set decoration to sort of subtly show the passage of time in this film? And like, what kind of research were you doing for this particular film? You know, mid-century America sort of time for The Irishman.
Wow. So for The Irishman, you know, I felt with that film, even though, you know, the characters, they're all, most of the film was about Italian Americans and that whole time period. And I kind of feel like I know a lot about that. You know, I'm from an Italian American family. I have a big family. I have so much research of my own, like photos from those periods of like my grandmother and like my aunts and uncles.
That's why Martin Scorsese picked you.
I hope so. I don't know. You know, but it resonated with me, and it was kind of like second nature to know like where and how and what all these places look like. But again, I mean, we did have a researcher on, and you do have to look at some, you know, history of like what Philadelphia looked like and what Detroit, because we had all these different hotel rooms and stuff like that. But it's all going back. It's a lot of research and trying to create these worlds and talking to the director and your production designer. And it's just a whole big collaboration.
Of course. I mean, because you sort of, the film moves between different locations, from mob hangouts to, you know, people's different homes and even like prison as well. So was there a particular set was like really challenging to do on this film?
Wow. It feels like years ago now. Well, it was.
I mean, it
ago.
Was. It was pre-COVID.
Oh my
so.
God. There were probably so many challenges on that film because we had so, I mean, there was, if I'm not mistaken, we had about 290 location, like sets and locations to do on that.
Yes.
One time we had on our stage in Brooklyn, we had about 7 sets that were standing, all like different hotel rooms. What was the biggest challenge on that? I think some of the challenges on that movie were like you said, the prison sets, finding so many big long prison tables that we ended up using picnic tables for, and like
really?
Steel
Picnic tables.
Yeah, it was things like that. It's like, oh my gosh, where are we going to find, you know, 16 long prison tables so that they look different from the other prison that we used, you know, the more traditional looking ones. So it was little things like that was hard. And then the other challenge on that movie was just the time that, even though we shot, I think we shot like 107 days or something, our schedule was just like, it was so one day after the other was just a big set, a big set, a big set.
Jam-packed.
Yeah.
And what about designing, you know, Frank Sheeran's home, you know, the main character in particular, what did you want it to say about his character and reflect about, I guess, his like his mindset, his mental state, and also just his character and his personality overall?
So I think, if I'm not mistaken, we had 2 homes for Frank Sheeran. I remember being, we have 2. Yeah, well, it was the passage of time. We started out early, like the one, there was like a, we built one. And I remember we were in his kitchen, like in the 1940s. So that was the 40s, 50s. That was really fun. But his, I mean, we wanted to make Frank's home, even though he was this powerful guy, I mean, he was a family man. And so his family home really reflected, like, I think, family and his wife and, you know, like their family bond. It was just really like a traditional, more traditional home. Whereas like in his office, it was a different Frank. And the thing about Frank Sheeran was that we actually had his granddaughter was working in the costume department and brought in photos of his home and his office. And
that's helpful.
Oh my God, it was crazy. And she gave me this piece of artwork that I used in his office. It was, yeah. So we really kind of want to reflect whatever the photos, you know, that she showed us of his home looked like.
And did you, you know, you were saying about your own sort of Italian-American heritage. Was there anything that you had specifically in your own homes growing up that you kind of brought into the film or recognized sort of when using, you know, the different props and decorating? Was there anything specific to
oh my God.
An Italian-American home? I don't know. I wouldn't know, but.
Oh, definitely. It was more like not my home growing up, but my grandmother's home or like my aunt's home, where like in, forgetting his name, but the Joe Pesci character's home, like we had smoked mirror glass behind the fireplace, which was a big thing. The really ornate kind of curtains with the big swaggy valances, you know, the kind of French provincial mid-century furniture that we use in the dining room and in the living room furnishings, you know, the kind of Italianesque artwork that was always a big thing. And I'm trying to remember if we used any plastic on the furniture in any of these homes, which plastic, you know, the plastic coverings over the furniture.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
That's a really big thing in like Italian American homes of that period.
Are they like really big on hygiene and or is it just
I don't know what it was, but
the furniture,
it was like, you know, like you're probably too young. It was like plastic. They still do it some places, but it was like plastic slip covers, see-through plastic, really thick with kind of like a gold trim around them.
Oh, like, okay.
And they
so you
were
could
in a
still
lot of,
see the, you know, the lovely
you could,
furniture.
You could
but
see,
the
you could see, yeah, you could see the cut velvet upholstery, but you couldn't, in case you spilled your milk or something.
I mean, definitely for cleaning purposes and not staining with, like, I don't know, red wine or something. It's like a great idea, but just the whole sound of sitting down on plastic. Just,
you know, sitting down in the summertime, it wasn't fun as a kid doing it.
No. I mean, actually, another film I can think that I've seen that is in My Big Fat Greek Wedding. I'm sure.
Oh yeah,
I think Greek furniture is covered in plastic as well.
It's same thing.
Maybe it's something I'll do when I'm older. I don't know when I'm like can't be bothered to clean anymore. And they say sort of that. Do you prefer that your set decoration goes unnoticed, or do you prefer it's noticed? Do you want people to be completely immersed, or do you want them to be picking out for all that color or the love of that design? Or no, do you prefer when it's just
no? I come from the school where, unless there's something in the script that says that something should be bright or sticking out, or this person, you know, is like this, I don't know, contemporary artist and has all this scribble on the wall or whatever. I mean, I think things should really just kind of sit back, relax, and be kind of like a cohort to the, they shouldn't be sticking out. I don't want to look at a movie and see, I'm going to be like, what's that behind his head? I feel like in a lot of movies lately, I see that, like I see this really crazy wallpaper and it really, I'm like, what is that? And it just kind of takes me out of the whole movie.
Yeah, it distracts you.
Yeah, like art should play a supporting role. And like I said, unless it's warranted somewhere in the script or the director asked for something, I don't think you should be looking at everything else. Mm. I mean, I don't mind beautiful piece somewhere here and there, but no, I don't want people to be picking it out.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke with Judy Becker, the production designer of The Brutalist, a week ago or so, and she was saying pretty much the same as you. You know, she loves that people are immersed in it, and that they, she even had a tattoo in Latin about art is in the invisibility of art or something like that. I probably re-quoted it wrong, but yeah, she said she watched a film where she saw this like lamp in it and she couldn't stop staring at the lamp. It was like a lamp that shouldn't have been there. She was like, it didn't look like it belonged. And I'm sure, you know, if you've got a good enough eye for design, you will notice when something does not look like it belongs there or in that time period.
Yeah. And I'm sure like next time you watch a film, like you'll see if something takes you out of it, just like if you're staring at something else, it's just taking away from the movie itself. And it's just, it really just kind of distracts me and takes me out of it. And yeah, that's not what we want to do at all.
And so more about, you know, so your career as a woman in the film industry, have you faced any challenges or barriers in your career? Or I mean, it sounds like for you it's been easy, but you know, maybe that's just, you know, my perspective. You know, I haven't seen all the maybe difficult days you've had or the challenges you've had, but have there been any? Have you had any moments of doubt along the way about what you were doing or the job itself?
No, I mean, nothing's ever easy. Maybe for some people, you know, I've been doing this a really long time. I think I have a really challenging job. Like I said, it's really high stress. I'm the kind of person, I love what I do. I know I'm never going to be a millionaire from doing this, but I love it. I think it's a privilege to go and do what I get to do every day and meet new people. I've had doubts sometimes, you know, when you finish or like you open a set and you're like, oh, maybe it doesn't look right. Or after I see it, I'm like, oh, why did I think about, you know, why did I do it that way? Or I think everyone always has doubts at some point, but I wouldn't change what I do ever. And yeah, I mean, with the bad days, you know, the good days probably outnumber the bad.
Yeah, definitely. Your love for the job outweighs any sort of stressful moments, I'm sure. Have you ever watched a film afterwards and thought, oh, I wish I could change that, and it's like too late? Or no, really?
Yeah.
That does happen. Because I feel like I've heard that happens a lot with directors. I'm sure it must be frustrating, you know, as you probably are all got that perfectionist sort of mindset where you'd like, oh, I probably would have changed that if I could, or changed the color of that or where that was positioned or something.
No, definitely. I've always thought that most, like I'll always watch. I mean, the first time I watch a film that I do, I'm probably more immersed in like the sets. You know, I am watching everything else behind them, and then I have to watch it again to actually get the whole thing. But yeah, there are a couple times like, oh, why did I put that piece of art there? Or oh my gosh, why did I do that? Or something. But my daughter or my friends will say like, what are you even talking about? I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, so I think even the average sort of moviegoer would not be picking it out, I don't think. Unless they're a set decorator themselves or production designer when they're really focusing on that sort of part of it. Would you say it's sort of a field, you know, set decoration where women have, you know, thrived? Do you think it's an industry that's sort of evolving, you know, for women behind the camera? I mean, I'm not familiar if there's a lot of women in set decoration or is it populated by...
I think they're lucky enough, there's a lot of women in set decorating. I mean, I would say we outnumber the men in set decorating. And I think we do thrive at, you know, this role. I don't think there's as many, maybe I'm wrong, but as many women production designers, which I'd like to see more of. I've worked for a lot of men, a couple of women, but I think it's you know, or women directors, like to see more of them.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely changing and evolving. And after speaking with Judy Beck the other day, really interesting to hear her sort of input. And ultimately, like, it comes down to just having a good imagination and creativity and a good vision to be a production designer, more than skill necessarily. She said, you know, you can learn that. So I think it's definitely something that could be, well, you know, you wanted to start out in interior design, but should be hopefully more known that these jobs exist, you know, like set decorating. Of course, it's not something that we're told about from a young age, you know, it's something you learn along the way, probably like you did. Yes. What advice would you give to someone wanting to sort of pursue a career in set decoration or production design?
Well, I would say get as much film experience as you can. I know, like for me in our department, set decorating, a lot of people start out in different ways. Some of them, I would definitely have an art background in school and anything. You know, you have to know your time period, you have to know your art, you have to know color theory, like all of these different things. And you should have some sort of a creative background. But going forward, you know, take as many jobs as you can as like a production assistant on a film, even if you're working, you know, as a production assistant in the art department or for the set decorating department, or even if you're an on-set production assistant. I think you find out so much working on a film set. You have to, I was also saying some people do start out in prop houses like I did, but also try to network and join groups. We have the Set Decorating Society of America, which have associate members and student members, and just learn as much as you can about the craft and put yourself out there. And I think it's all about networking and working your way up.
Mm, definitely. Good advice. And if you could work on any sort of dream project, you know, have you got any dream directors you'd love to work with, or a particular time period that you'd love to work on and decorate that you haven't yet?
I love period films. I would love to do like a sci-fi, which I mean, Fallout was kind of like a post-apocalyptic sci-fi, but not really sci-fi. I would love to work for Quentin Tarantino, Christopher Nolan. You know, I would love to do something like a Dune or something like Robert Eggers, like Nosferatu, like some big period. I don't know. I love just, you know, period, something big. I like big period sci-fi.
The bigger, the better. And what's next for you? Have you got any exciting projects on the horizon? Anything you're working on that you can talk about and that you're looking forward to, or things in the pipeline?
No, unfortunately, I have nothing at the moment, but hoping something comes in soon. It's been a little slow in New York, so
I'm sure something will come up. I mean, you've already worked on so many amazing films and projects, but maybe also it's a good time as well as into, like, in your time when you're not working, are you doing a lot of, not research on purpose, but as a sort of hobby, you know, going to museums maybe, or?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And when I'm not working, it's really funny because then I get kind of, I just design a barbershop for my cousin, you know, and my husband has a pizzeria, so I'm always designing things for him or inside there. And so I always kind of get roped into of doing something for
doing your sort of, you know, dabbling back in your sort of interior design world. Sure. Can you name 5 of your favorite films for their production design?
That's a hard one.
It usually is the hardest question for most people. They're like, oh, my brain's gone blank. I do not know.
But I'm going to say 5, but I don't know if they're my top 5, but they might be. I'm going to say Willy Wonka, the original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Poor Things, 2001 Space Odyssey, Age of Innocence. There Will Be Blood.
Great choices. I mean, now that you actually say about, you know, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, that is incredible. And considering it was made such a long time ago, and as well for Space Odyssey, that was also made such a long ago. Like, how did they achieve something that looks like that when the sort of tools at their disposal at the time, you know, they're more limited than they are now. So it's incredible what they were able to achieve.
Yeah, you can like look back at those movies and they're just so timeless.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I love the more recent, you know, Willy Wonka with Timothée Chalamet, obviously. I love how you call him Timmy. That's like, oh my God, basically you're on friend level with him.
I worked with him a couple of times. So, well, that, and I did a Chanel commercial with him. So, yeah, well, it's Timmy.
Me and my friend are absolutely obsessed with him, like probably millions of other girls.
Yeah.
And we communicate through memes and videos and photos of Timmy. We actually don't even ask each other how we are anymore. We're just like, oh, look at this picture of Timmy doing this or that.
That's so funny. Well, I hope that he comes through at the Oscar. He works so hard.
Hopefully, because, you know, I've heard all the work he put into it, you know, learning to sing and play the guitar, and like there's just so much in that role. But yeah, well, thank you so much for talking with me today, and it's been really interesting, and I've loved hearing about your job as a set decorator and also about what you did for Complete Unknown. I'm going to watch it again and think about all the things you've told me. Yeah, thank you so much. It's been great to chat.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Have a good day.
And that's a wrap on today's episode of The Real Girls Club. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Regina Graves as much as I did. It's always such a privilege to hear from the women shaping the visual worlds we fall in love with on screen. From Dylan's New York to The Prisons of the Irishman, Regina's work reminds us just how powerful the details can be and how much care and creativity goes into every frame. If you like this episode, don't forget to follow, rate and share The Real Girls Club wherever you get your podcasts, and come and hang out on Instagram too. You can find us at Real Girls Club for behind the scenes content, guest highlights and much more. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you in the next one.